reality. Death. To the prophets as they proclaim there is but one God who you should trust. So there's a massive need for change because of idolatry and then the blindness and the deafness. You see, Cyrus will bring about a political change. Yes, he will allow God's people to come out of Babylon and go back to the promised land. We've seen that repeatedly. But he can't do anything about people's hearts. He can change outwardly things, but he can't change inwardly. There's a greater need than anything Cyrus can give. So we move from the need for change to, well, what hope is there? What hope is there for change? Now the next slide. You've already seen some shards of light, some shards cracking darkness in terms of the hope.
Just like promises, reiterating God's commitment to his people. God telling his people, yes, I know your sin. I know your blindness. I know your deafness. And I know the nations around are stuffed full of idols. But I'm not going to abandon you. God's people, I'm with you. Just as I led that first generation out of Egypt, so I will lead you out of Babylon. I will guide you, I will feed you, I will nourish you, I will care for you on the journey. So we've seen some shards of light of hope, that there can be hope for change. And if you like, if they're the shards, then by the time we come to chapter 42, we've come to the bright midday sun of change. And in particular, we're introduced to God's agent of change. God's agent of change. I wonder if you can see it there in verse 1 of chapter 42. He's not given a name, but a title. The servant. Verse 1, behold my servant whom I uphold. This is God speaking. God is presenting this servant, this idyllic Israelite who is not blind, who is not deaf, and he's presenting them to all his people. He's saying, look, here is my servant, my chosen one, who I delight in. He is the one who I am sending to be the agent of change, to bring hope to despair, where there's despair. Over the past 6 months in our all-age services, we considered the servant of the Lord, but we treated some of the passages in isolation. But we get a greater richness and a greater blessing by seeing them in the flow of the story. It's a bit like if you go into London and you want to go and visit some of the big tourist sites, maybe Big Ben, Buckingham Palace, House of Parliament, maybe a theatre or two. And the great beauty of London is that you've got your travel card, haven't you? And you can just dive into the nearest underground station and then pop up overground at your location. But you don't get much of a feel for where everything fits into the flow of London. You've just got isolated places that you know by an underground map. Well, because I'm a tight-fisted Welshman, I just get a ticket to St Pancras and then just use my bike to get to places I need to go. Right? And actually what you do is you begin to see where everything fits overground in reality. So you get to Buckingham Palace, not via the Central Line or the Northern Line, but as it is above ground. You get a better picture, a better flow of where everything is. You understand its context. So it is as we come into the servant passages. Five passages between now and chapter 55, all telling us about the character and the mission of the servant, but now we can see it in its flow. Now we understand why we have a need for the servant, because of the idolatry and the blindness. Now we see a reason for the hope that we have because of the despair that we're left to by ourselves. So this one servant is presented to Israel. But you think, hang on, we saw in chapter 42, verse 18 and 19 that also the nation was given that title servant, and they're blind and deaf. So how can we have this other servant? Or is it the same one? Well, I try and think of it like this. The servant in the verse 1 is like capital S. There is one servant who is unique, who is the perfect Israelite, and he's been presented to the small s servants, those who are God's people. If God's people want to know how to live in covenant faithfulness, how to live in relationship with God, look to the capital S servant of Yahweh. This is how we live. This is how we're to live in relationship with God, by looking at the servant, the agent of change. And in verses 1 to 4, we're particularly drawn to his character. First of all, if I can have the next slide, thank you. First of all, we can see, we've seen that he's chosen. Well, second, we see that he's a quiet servant. Look at verse 2, chapter 42, verse 2. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. It's in contrast to King Cyrus or any kind of kingly figure or royal or political figure. There's no huge song and dance. There's no royal fanfare. There's no red carpet being laid out and all the kind of the fans celebrating his arrival. There's no tanks, there's no guns, there's no bodyguards. No, he is quiet. He will go about his mission in a quiet way. He will come in an unexpected way, in an unexpected place. That's his character. He is quiet. And then we see verse 3 that he's gentle. A bruised reed he will not break. A faintly burning wick of a candle he won't quench. You can have the picture. Next slide. Thank you. Imagine you're by the sea and you see all these beautiful reeds. But rather than it being a nice gentle day, it's a blowing storm. What's that wind going to do? Well, it's going to blow over those reeds. It's going to break some of them. And what we're told is, well, that's not what the servant is going to be like. He won't break people who are already half broken. He won't go up to the oppressed or the poor, the afflicted, and condemn them. He will treat people with dignity. He will reach out to the lowly. To those who are oppressed, he makes a particular point of going towards. This is the character. As we come to the New Testament, we see in various places that this servant is clearly Jesus. If you're taking notes, you want references, Matthew chapter 12, where this passage is quoted. So now what we're to do is we're to kind of read Jesus into all these character descriptions. Jesus is the quiet servant. Jesus is the gentle and lowly and humble servant of the Lord. But of course, we also know that Jesus is the King. And so it's a royal servant. He is the servant King. Up the next picture. A few weeks ago, I'm sure many of you saw this on the news, King Charles was visiting cancer patients in hospital. And of course, we know that King Charles himself has got cancer. So here is the royal figure, the King of Britain, the King of the Commonwealth. And yet he is here being shown as lowly and gentle and humble, reaching out to those who are likewise suffering. Well, it's just a snippet, a glimmer of a picture of the greater servant, King Jesus. There's a lovely story in Luke chapter 8 of a lady who's been bleeding for many years. And by status, she should be totally kind of ostracized, not coming out in public at all. Just kept under wraps, out of society. And yet she hears Jesus is in town, and so she comes to try and meet him. But Luke, as he tells the story, says the crowd just impinged upon Jesus. So many people wanting to get close to him that she couldn't. And yet she just reaches out to touch his cloak. And Jesus immediately notices that the power has gone out from him. And turns to this great crowd and says, who is it that touched me. And this lady comes forward and says, it's me. Well, what led the lady to do that act? Why break all social, cultural, ethnic boundaries to go and touch Jesus? Well, it must be because she knows his character. She must be clear that he is gentle and humble, not condemning, not finger wagging. And what does Jesus say when he sees that it's this lady? He says, daughter. Do you hear that word, daughter? Not nobody, as everyone else is, but daughter, your faith has healed you. Isn't Jesus wonderful? Isn't his character magnificent? Doesn't he just draw you towards him? He should. He is the gentle and lowly royal servant. Maybe in the past, or maybe you've heard of being, or you've experienced church leaders or people in authority condemning you, bruising you, crushing you. And you therefore have a fear of trust in church leaders, perhaps, or even in Jesus himself. Because you go, well, if that's how the people of Jesus represent him, then that's what Jesus must be like. But he's not. And we want to once more reach out and see Jesus. Not the small s servants, but the royal S, big capital S servant Jesus, as the gentle and humble and lowly one who we can trust with our lives, because he is gentle and lowly towards those who are also low and humble. Well, maybe you're going, that's great. That's great, Gareth. It's great that we can see Jesus in all his wonderful gentle and lowliness. But such a character, they can't bring about change. You know, that's when we need the Donald Trump-like figures, you know, or a Putin-like figure. We need the tanks and the bombs. That's what brings about change. Not gentle, lowly characters. Well, let's evaluate the servant's mission now. Sorry, let's look at the servant's mission and then evaluate for yourselves whether or not such a servant can bring about change. Next slide, please. Umang. Yeah. So let's look then at the servant's mission. Look back at verses 1 to 4. And I think three times you should see a repeated phrase there. That gives us a clue that this matters. What's the repeated phrase? Well, it's the servant will bring justice. Look at verse 3. He will faithfully bring forth justice. Elsewhere we see it's going to be bringing justice not just within Israel, but to the nations. We're back in our court scenes that we've had before in Isaiah. When we think about justice, we're thinking about law, we're thinking about courts. And we saw previously in Isaiah that God was bringing the nations and their gods before him into his courtroom. They were accused of being idol worshippers, of trusting in idols to bring salvation, of forgetting that there was one God, thinking that there were many small g gods. And God is bringing them into the court and saying, all right, well, let's have some tests. If you think your gods are the ones that rule the world, let them predict the future. And we saw that they were unable to. And then God says, well, let me show that I am the one true God by telling you the future before it happens and then acting upon it. Well, we're kind of back in that scene now. Because God has injustice against him. The idolatry and the blindness of God's people and the nations is an injustice. It's an affront to God. He is not being treated fairly. And so now we're being told that the servant will be God's agent of justice. The justice that God requires, that is rightfully his, will be met, will be found through his servant Jesus. The servant will bring the truth that there is but one God and one Saviour to the world, thus bringing justice to God. Now, for the people who were hearing this originally, and perhaps for yourself, if you're familiar with Isaiah, this should cause flashbacks to you. The servant's mission to bring justice, that's not the first time we've read of this. In one of those famous Christmas passages in Isaiah 9, you know, where we have, to us a child is born, to us a saviour is given. Upon his shoulders, I've forgotten the words, but he will, sorry. Thank you. The government will be upon his shoulders, and he will bring forth a kingdom of justice, of love, and of peace. Now there in Isaiah 9, that's not talking about the servant, that's talking about a royal figure, a king. So we've got extra dosages, you like, of Jesus being the servant king. It's the king who is the servant who will bring God's justice to the nations. But look at verse 4. This isn't going to be any easy mission. He will not grow faint or be discouraged until he has established justice in the earth. This is going to be a long game. This isn't any quick fix to bring justice. You can have the next slide. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was a Christian, a theologian and a pastor in Germany under the Hitler regime in Nazi Germany. And he was a campaigner and an activist for getting rid of Hitler. He could see before the war began, once Hitler came to power, the damage that he was going to do, and did what he could to get rid of him. This is his words. When assaulted by evil, we must oppose it directly. We have no other option. But it's also clear we have no justification for preferring one response over another. And so he was willing to play the long game. To start with, he tried to work within the church and set up the new confessing church over against Hitler's state church. But when that wasn't getting much traction in terms of trying to get rid of Hitler, he then worked with other activists. But it took until in a final attempt in 1944, with the Munich bombings, to try and dispose of Hitler. And of course we know in history that it failed. But time and time again, as I read his biography, I was thinking, why don't you act now? Why don't you act now? But he was always willing to play that long game. He persevered in his mission until it cost him his own life. So it is with Jesus, the servant king. He was willing to persevere. It wasn't going to be easy, but he wouldn't grow faint. You see, even in the Garden of Gethsemane, just before the cross, he was tired, he was weary, but he didn't give up on the mission. He didn't throw in the towel like the trainer might in a boxing ring. No, King Jesus, the servant of God, persevered all the way unto the cross in order to bring justice about. So how will this justice be established? How will this kingdom of justice and love and peace be established? Well, look at verse 6. Isaiah 42, verse 6, you can see it there. I will give you as a covenant for the people. That's God, Yahweh, saying this to the servant. I will make you, Jesus, a covenant for the people. A covenant is that binding agreement between two parties. And here we're being told that the servant will be that mediator, that go-between. He will be the representative between God, who's been offended by the injustice, and the nations and God's people who are full of idolatry and blind and deaf. The servant will be the mediator. And of course, such words should make us think of Jesus' words himself. As he was in that upper room with his disciples just before he was arrested in the garden, he took the cup and he said, "This is the blood of the new covenant shed for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Jesus saying, my body, my blood is the new covenant. I am the way to deal with the idolatry, the injustices that have been caused by your sin. I am the way for forgiveness. Through my death, I will be that gentle and lowly servant to bring justice to God by taking the injustice myself. And with that, we're going to pause and actually celebrate the Lord's Supper together now before we look at how we should respond. So if John and James, you'd like to give out the bread and the wine. Just as a reminder, while this has been given out, this is a meal for the Lord's people, those who know and trust the servant Jesus. If you're not sure that that's you, we look forward to the day when that is you. But for now, just let the bread and the wine pass by. And the servant's mission. So how then should we respond? Well, it's wonderful because Isaiah tells us, or more accurately, the Lord tells us through Isaiah. Look at verses 10 to 12. Isaiah 42, verses 10 to 12. Sing. There you go. That's, we're commanded, aren't we? That's our response to the servant's work. Sing to the Lord a new song, his praise from the end of the earth. You who go down to the sea and all that fills it, the coastlands and their inhabitants, let the desert and its cities lift up their voice. The villages of Kedar inhabits. Let the inhabitants of Salis sing for joy. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the coastlands. Do you see that? What's our response to the servant's work? What's our response to the change that's possible? Well, sing. But notice the breadth of the song. This isn't just a few people in Hope Church Bedford. This isn't even all the inhabitants, all the Christians of Bedford. It's not even all the Christians around the world. In words reminiscent of the Psalms, it's all creation. Even the sea creatures, we're told there, giving praise to God for his faithfulness in sending the servant with his character and his mission. That's the response. Praise. That should always be our first response. Praise be to God for sending the Saviour. Praise be to Jesus the servant for being the servant, the one who would persevere unto death. Well, what's the content of this song? It's all very well being told to sing, but what are we to sing? Well, do you notice in verse 10, we're told that it's a new song. That means that before the servant came, people couldn't sing this song. It's new because it's celebrating a fresh stage, indeed the climactic stage of God's saving story. That's why the people before the servant couldn't sing it. But still you say, well, tell me the words of this song. Well, in Isaiah, we don't have them. Isaiah was looking forward to the time when the servant would come and they'd be able to sing this song. But in the final book of the Bible, where we started in our call to worship, John, who writes Revelation, well, he looks back. He looks back at the completed story of salvation and he knows the song. He hears it as he sees and hears what's going on in heaven. And that was the song that we started with, Revelation chapter 5, verses 8 to 10. Worthy is the Lamb. Worthy is Jesus because you were slain. Worthy because your death has brought about the forgiveness of sin. It's brought about a kingdom of love, of peace, of forgiveness, of justice. It's brought about a global kingdom because all people from all tribes and tongues and all nations and all creation can sing the song of the Lamb, of the servant who persevered unto death. I don't know if you've seen in Bedford Park or around Bedford, there's various posters of the summer concerts coming up. I think it might even be starting next weekend. And we've got Tom Jones, if you're the older generation. You know, that great song, Delilah. You know, or if you're a bit younger, you know, you might remember Avril Lavigne and her wonderful song, Skater Boy. And those songs, as I see the posters, recall those songs. I remember the songs when I was a bit younger. As we read this poster, this call to praise, it should be reminding us of the servant's work, of the servant's character, and it should lead us to praise. It should lead us to go, worthy indeed are you, Jesus, because you were the servant who was slain for my sin. You're the servant who's brought God's justice, and I want to praise you. So is change possible? Absolutely. But it will only happen if our hearts are captivated by Jesus. Only if we're captivated by his character and his work will we have a joy that then overflows. Only once we're captivated and captured by Jesus will we want to sing those songs of praise. Only when we're captivated by Jesus will our lives begin to reflect Jesus more closely, and will we make an impact on the world around us. Change is possible. The question really is, do we desire it? Just a moment to reflect, and then I'll pray.